Today, stagflation, trick or treat. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's Latest Post covering finance and property news. Today I'm joined again by Tarek for a Friday afternoon tech. Tarek, hello, welcome back. Nice to see it with you. As we were saying, crazy, crazy times.
Well, definitely, mate. You know, we've seen some very, very surprising, well, perhaps not surprising to you and I, but surprising stuff surrounding the issue of inflation from the ABS, and then quite shocking commentary from some of the banks saying rate cut cycle over.
Yes, I have to say, when I saw the latest inflation numbers and also Michelle Bullock's comments on Monday, I think she knew that something was up with the projections. And if you compare the forward projection in her last statement and what we're actually seeing, we're streets apart now. And what I've found very surprising in all of this is how surprised everybody is. They should be listening to us. We've been talking about this for a long time. We knew this was happening.
Well, we did, didn't we? I mean, you know, we looked at all the other inflation data coming from places like Canada, Britain, New Zealand, America, and you look at that and then it was like, well, inflation's picking up there. Why won't it pick up here? What makes us different? And part of what I think of what led to this sort of degree of complacency around surrounding inflation is the electricity subsidies. They distorted headline inflation lower, and I think that gave people a false sense of security that inflation had been tamed when it hadn't. And I think the thing is that it's not just the electricity subsidies unwinding now that's the problem. That is definitely a contributing factor to the headline inflation rate rising, but we're now seeing the trimmed mean rate of inflation rising as well. So it's problems across the board.
Well, I called this trick or treat because, you know, there was a trick in this from Chalmers earlier on, and of course the States too, when they handed out all this money to people to disguise the true level of inflation before the election. That's yeah. That was a deception, right? That was a trick. And we were saying at the time, it's going to come back to bite. And meantime, the true costs of electricity are continuing to rise. But more importantly, and this is a critical point, the breadth of the inflationary pulse that we're seeing now is spreading. A lot of services, of course, as well as goods. And whilst there's been some movement positive in some food categories, you know, some much higher, of course, with coffee and what have you, the overall trajectory looks as though inflation now is definitely on the up. The unemployment number, of course, which was the other number that shocked earlier on, a lot of people said, oh, well, that means they've got a cut. But Ms. Michelle said, you know, the monthly unemployment numbers are wobbly anyway. They go up all over the place. And still, she's talking relatively full employment. So we have a couple of contentions here. And then, of course, we have a growth number, which is looking pretty weak as well at the moment because the economic activity is not really very strong, which takes us into that rather uncomfortable land of stagflation.
It does. And I think the thing is that when it comes to the issue of stagflation, of, you know, stagnating economic growth and, you know, historically rising unemployment, I think in a lot of ways, for a lot of the households, Australians have been experiencing stagflation now for quite some time. Okay, they haven't lost their jobs in this traditional sense of stagflation, but they've seen their living standards go backwards as if stagflation was playing out. And I mean, this is something I think that you previously discussed with Leith from Macro Business in terms of the fact that, you know, Australian living standards are basically flatlining in terms of where they were compared with the pre-pandemic. But then you look at where they are in the rest of the advanced economies within the OECD, and they're still continuing to improve. You know, people can say, oh, but it's demographics, oh, but it's this, but Australia's demographics are some of the best in the developed world. Yet here we are going nowhere, and much of the improvement that we have seen has been driven by changes in the composition of the population, as we discussed, I think it was in the last show, when you're replacing children in the population with working age adults, of course, obviously there's going to be that corresponding rise. And once you account for that, we're going nowhere.
Well, I think that's the point. And one of the things I always come back to, and of course we've talked about this before, that averaging masks a lot of differences. And, you know, this trick-or-treat issue, there are some people who are feeling really good about things because their incomes are booming. They feel pretty affluent because the stock market is rising and the property prices, of course, are rising again. And so for that particular segment of the population, they're doing and feeling pretty good about things. But on the other end of the spectrum, if you look at those in the rental sector or at least half of those with a mortgage, it's a completely different story. And I get a bit frustrated with some of this talk about everything's great, everything's fine. You know, Chalmers is saying, you know, together we're actually, you know, tackling whatever it is we're tackling. The truth is that there are a lot of people who are worse, way worse off than they were a decade ago. And there's no path out of that at the moment. And in fact, the policies, both federal and state, but particularly federal with migration, and some of the other things that are going on with some of the, you know, the property shenanigans as well, is creating this bigger and bigger gulf. And I don't really see much discussion about the granularity below the top line numbers. I mean, a lot of the economists are talking, you know, top line here, there, and there, and even the RBA, and they say, well, we don't really have enough tools in our toolkit to be able to actually drill down. Well, they should be drilling down, because your average younger Australian today, particularly those who may be in the sort of housing formation mode, are really under the gun and have been under the gun for a long period of time. And there is no clear path forward other than more trick and treat. And it's unfortunately more trick than treat.
It is disappointing, because I think that on one hand, we look at the numbers for, say, retirees, you know, for particularly new retirees, and they are getting ahead like perhaps never before. You know, they're doing very, very well for themselves compared with the cohort that they are replacing. Yet, if you then look at the headline data in terms of, not the headline data, you then look at the population composition adjusted data on, say, living standards, and you see that the average is going nowhere. And it's like, okay, well, if the average is going nowhere and we've got this affluent group of retirees who's getting ahead, then who's falling behind? And I think that's one of the key themes in the Australian economy, basically since the GFC. The fact that you've got all these different groups falling behind, but that's not being captured very well. Like, there's a productivity paper, I think they put out in just prior to the pandemic, it was 2018, 2019, and it looks at the level of wages growth by age demographic. And it breaks it down by about a 7-year period between 2001 and 2008, and then 2001 and 2008, and then 2008 to 2015 or whatever it was, or something along those lines. I forget the exact dates, but you get the theme. And it shows that prior to the GFC, the wage gains within the economy were relatively evenly spread across the various different age demographics in real terms. But then you look at what happens after the GFC, and all of a sudden you start to see people under the age of 35 fall behind, and fall behind fairly significantly, because you're still seeing the sort of, you know, 55 to 64 age demographics getting ahead, while the younger demographics basically went nowhere. And that, I think, is something that's just bizarrely overlooked, and people just look around dumbfounded as, oh, well, how is this happening? And it's just like, it's called weak business investment, relatively anemic growth in living standards, and the big one, expanding the population via migration into those very demographics, thereby increasing the supply of labor, which does what, according to basic year 10 business studies?
And of course, if you add then the other part of it, and all of those people need somewhere to live, and they either rent or they are trying to buy a property, which of course then puts the very significant rocket under property prices in particular. But I would note that the latest data from the RBA, the aggregates to the end of September, show that investment lending is still rising a lot faster than owner-occupied lending. considerably faster. And in fact, the investment lending trends have accelerated over the last 12 months. So you've got this massive inequality between those trying to get into the market for the first time buyers included, and the property investors, who will be often more affluent, older households, who seem to be having a bit of a ball at the moment as prices rise. So we are in a very uncomfortable position. And again, I don't think that these partials, you know, this understanding down at that granular level feeds sufficiently in to the thinking of policy, nor indeed monetary policy. And I have a feeling that it's almost deliberate. It's almost like, well, we, you know, if we look at the average, on average, you know, things maybe not too bad, but on average is meaningless because people are not on average okay. And unfortunately, the policy makers and the policy setters, and of course, all of those who are spruiking, are focusing in on a particular segment of the market. And, you know, buy now, you know, all these wonderful first owner grant things will change the game, you know. And Claire O'Neill, do you see that video that she did the other day, which was completely not explaining well the way that property markets really work? I mean, this was a mess and it's continuing to be a mess, but I don't think people in power want to actually engage in the real conversation.
One of the problems with engaging in a real conversation and actually trying to at least just even making an attempt to tackle an issue is it creates the expectation that you will actually tackle said issue. But they don't want to. They're very, very concerned and, you know, dare I say it, afraid of what will happen to the economy if housing prices do go down, you know, do tank. Because, I mean, realistically speaking, as we covered this quite well in our last video, that organic entry into the property market for the first time is an increasingly endangered species. Mm. People, you know, the overwhelming, you know, majority of people are getting in from with help from either government or the bank of mum and dad, or as you correctly pointed out last time, both. So I think in some ways the market is more vulnerable than it appears to be, you know, as this unstoppable juggernaut. But then by the same token, if something does arise that would create downside for the property market, it's time to crack open the treasury coffers and start throwing money at the problem until, you know, basically until property prices start rising again or they stabilize. I mean, there's always, you know, what I basically consider to be, you know, the nuclear option to protect the market, which is, you know, the Rudd Howard option of just cash grants for first home buyers. You know, okay, it may cost $5 billion, it may cost $10 billion, but for them, that's chump change to potentially save the property market.
Yes, and of course, the risks to the property market mean financial stability risks too, because the banks are so leveraged up, and they, of course, are relying more and more on lending for housing rather than actually lending to business, as we've discussed previously. So, yeah, but I think you're right. I'm not sure that those in authority want to actually rock the boat too much. And, of course, the truth is that you know, politicians, when it comes to the election, don't want to be the politicians who actually dropped home prices. And so we get all these commitments about ongoing price growth. Oh, yeah, no, it's fine. Everything's good. The result, of course, as we say, is this unequal situation where many people are caught, which takes us quite nicely, actually, to, well, so what are people actually doing? You know, how are they working? And what is the true story? And how does migration feed into this picture? And I think you've got some rather interesting charts that we should probably look at.
As usual, ladies and gentlemen, the slides will be available at burnouteconomics.com. I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who has subscribed and contributed, both on an ongoing basis and on a one-off basis. It very much helps me keep the lights on while I go off on these little side quests. And without any further delay, we should get straight into it. Oh, and I just will make one little interesting mention. I thought this cartoon was particularly funny, considering the fact that Powell acknowledged the existence of the K-shaped economy in his recent press conference following the Fed rate meeting.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth, Tarek. Yes, it's very important that he's now talking about this as well, as we've been talking about for quite some time. And it's fascinating to me that when you ask the question, so who is in the top of the K, the OK and who is not okay, there's a very strong correlation between those in the markets, stock markets in particular, and those who are not. And there's also a very strong correlation between age as well. So if you're older and invested, you're probably okay. If you're younger and not invested because you don't have the cash, then you're not okay. And this split between the two is getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Indeed, it's actually quite interesting. There's a polling company. I forget exactly what it's called. It's a Roman name, but it'll come to me. Anyway, they've been doing polling now for a couple of years on a consistent monthly basis on how people feel towards the economy by age demographic. And if you ask young people, they think it's horrible. You know, sort of the worst it is since their records began. But if you ask older people, it's a lot more mixed. And I think that's very much the sort of mix that you're talking about in terms of the more affluent end of town and the sort of just everyday Americans. Because I think the thing is that there is a very, very affluent, wealthy demographic amongst the older cohort, but I don't think it's as large as the sort of enormous amount of wealth that they have implies, because it's not evenly split. It's a very, very wealthy cohort, and then there's sort of just everybody else.
Yes, if you look at the distribution, it's in the US in particular, you know, it's the very few percent that have pretty much half of all the wealth and assets in the country. Now, it's not quite so extreme in Australia, although it's pretty extreme, actually. And I agree with you. It's much, much more concentrated. And, of course, a lot of those people are saying, I don't see what the problem is. You know, we're doing really well. But no, look over your shoulder. Look at your neighbours. Look at the people down in the other suburbs. They're the people who are actually the real Australians or the real people in the US. And, you know, incomes in real terms going nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a good chart from Moody's recently. Basically, since 2019, people with incomes outside of the top 20% have seen their consumption spending basically go nowhere since 2019. I mean, obviously that it's gone on a roller coaster ride, but it's basically not grown compared with where it was in 2019. But then you'd look at the top 20% and their spending has rocketed. And then if you look even closer, that I think Moody's singled out the top 3.4%, which is a very random number, but we'll go with it. For them, their spending had just absolutely moved since 2019. So it's very much, you know, a game of very different demographics.
Yeah, and then that takes us quite nicely to this idea about the concentration of different groups and the working age population, which is what this chart's all about.
Indeed. Now, I think this is very interesting because what this shows is the growth in the working age population since the middle of 2023. It's grown by almost 5%. Yet somehow the number of hours worked in the market sectors of the economy, which is everything except public administration, education, and healthcare and social assistance, every sector outside of that in the economy is now actually having fewer hours worked in it than it was 2 years ago, despite the fact that the population is 5% larger. Now, I think that's quite striking because that means that at a very, very broad aggregate level, there isn't any more plumbers unclogging toilets. There isn't more people stacking shelves. There isn't more anything at an aggregate level. So I think that that's really just a striking fact. The fact that we can't get the market sector of the economy to fire and actually get people into work. Now, this is one of the reasons why I've been warning about the possibility of rising unemployment for quite some time now. Because, put simply, the genuine private sectors of the economy, which are unaligned to those government contracts, have been struggling for a long time. But because the government has been spending so much, and when I say government, I mean government across all levels, have been spending so much on employing more people, it's kept the plate spinning. But now the government has started to pull back on that. It's revealing this weakness, and that's why we're seeing rising unemployment.
Yeah, and it's worth highlighting that the government spending on that particular area has started to tail back because, of course, it was unsustainable. But the private investment is still very, very anemic. And that's partly because, of course, businesses are saying, well, it's tough to invest in the current environment. Or if we want to invest, maybe we should invest in the US rather than in Australia.
It's a very difficult set of circumstances because it's not something that's new. This is the culmination of what we've been seeing now for the best part of 15, almost 20 years now of declining business investment outside of the mining sector. Now, the mining boom artificially boosted things there for a while, but once that faded, that's when, you know, the economy was really forced to stand on its own. And it hasn't really done that all that well. You know, since 2015, we've seen, you know, the inexorable rise of government as a source of economic activity. And since 2008, we've seen the meteoric rise of government as the employer of last resort, shall we call it, albeit through, you know, various different private sector mechanisms, which the taxpayer ultimately pays for.
Well, that's why the take from tax is as high as it's ever been. And the chances are it'll have to go higher. And that's why Chalmers is looking for all sorts of different additional ways to try and tax people, you know, whether it's superannuation or whatever, because the balance between tax take and tax paid is all over the place. And I think that the COVID experience, where, of course, government threw money at absolutely everything and everyone pretty much, is an illustration of the problem. People then say, well, governments can do that then. Why can't they go on doing it? Well, there's a consequence of all of this. And the consequence is essentially lack of investment in things for the future. A lot of government spending on day-to-day being taken from the tax take, which means the tax take has to go up. And that's very hard to unwind.
Indeed, and I think that is prophetic and a bit of a warning here going forward, because government as a day-to-day government spending as a percentage of GDP has gone up over 4 percentage points. It's gone up almost 20% in relative terms compared with the size of where it was. So that is, if you look at, say, for example, you look at day-to-day government spending during the global financial crisis when the Rudd government threw the kitchen sink at the economy, that's a blip. That's about one-eighth of what we've seen in terms of the size of government expansion over the last decade. So really, and this is particularly more recently, so really what we've seen is basically a government stimulus to support the economy on a constant basis. So there's a lot less scope in the future to support the economy through stimulus without just going to just untold levels of government spending as a proportion of economic activity in Australia, yeah, excluding obviously the war, etc. But it, as you say, it leaves the economy vulnerable to when you have to finally remove that scaffolding and has to stand on its own.
And two quick observations on that. Did you see Chris Richardson's recent note where he made the point that the deficit, well, depending on how you calculate it, you know, is coming down slightly on a rolling basis or not, but there's a lot of off-budget expenditure, which is actually should be included, but probably isn't included in the normal numbers. So that's half the story. The other one, of course, is that the government deficits are still very big. You have to pay interest on that deficit, and with interest rates now where they are, that's costing a lot more too. So effectively, the government's finding it harder and harder to be able to balance the books because the amount they're having to pay on the interest on the debt, because the debt's bigger, is also another pressure on the economy as well.
Yep, and there's also the, you know, the ongoing meteoric rise in the cost of the NDIS and aged care, which are both, you know, sort of rising significantly more strongly than was originally anticipated.
Spot on.
Now, speaking of economic growth, during the GFC, Australia got very, very lucky. It have managed to avoid a recession in headline terms, even though it ended up in a per capita one for quite some time. But it basically got a head start on the rest of the world. It had this enormous boom, which boosted GDP, which boosted output. And as you can see from the chart above, it gave Australia a huge leg up on the US. But particularly since the 2017-2019 period, that has slowed and the US has caught up. But in the sort of post-pandemic era of anemic GDP per capita growth, the US has now streaked ahead. And I just think it's worth noting that we had a similar chart last time I was here, which showed Australia was actually behind Japan. Japan's lost decade in terms of GDP per capita, comparing Japan's lost decade and Australia's last decade. So we're very much falling behind the pack.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to compare the US story with the Australian story. And of course, more recently, the US story has been stoked by this massive investment boom in AI. If you look carefully, pretty much all of the growth in the US economy in recent times, looking at the share price, is all about AI, and it's about that particular segment of the market. So if that were to go pop for any reason, different story. But clearly, we're heading in the wrong direction in Australia, looking at the way that that is now dropping back. This is the GDP per capita, which, of course, is the right way to measure it. The other angle on this, of course, is that the US has dialed back migration. In fact, they're kicking people out of the country, whereas Australia, well, migration's on the up again.
It is, and I think in some ways it just sort of illustrates the diminishing returns on a poorly targeted migration system. Mm. Now, don't get me wrong, when migration is well targeted and it boosts productivity, it helps to build this necessary infrastructure, it helps to boost business investment, etc., it can be a great thing. But by the government's own admission, I think it was Assistant Minister Thistlethwaite, the Assistant Immigration Minister, who had a quite frank, to his credit, speech that he did on this that basically said that it's of, at best, marginal benefit to the economy. And I think that that's just a pretty sad indictment of the state of the migration system. And I just think that there's a better path there, but it's a challenging one, I think, because in years gone by, it was a lot easier to get skilled migrants. There was a lot less competition on that front. But these days, you know, say for example, if you're looking for, you know, nurses or doctors or et cetera, you know, so here in Australia, we're stripping the NHS. You know, if you go into an Australian hospital in a metro area these days, you wouldn't be at all surprised to, in the last time, I was in there visiting someone, it was, you know, Scottish accents, English, Welsh, you know, Irish. You know, we're Australia's, you know, stripping the NHS clean for, you know, nurses and doctors. And, well, you know, Brits are suffering as a result.
Yes. And in the UK, we have more and more people who migrants into the UK with medical qualifications, because they are in turn harvesting some of those newly trained medics from places like India, for example. So you've got this massive, international dance in terms of trying to get people to come and work in the health service. But again, it doesn't bode well. And the question of migration is simply this. It's not just about numbers. It's about the quality of the migrants and about the capability that they bring. If you can bring the right people in with the right skills and experience, then you can definitely make it work, economically speaking. But if you don't do that, you end up with a bigger number of people who are effectively diluting overall the economic return. And that is, well, where we are, but unsustainable.
The thing I think is funny is that Australia's policymakers take the wrong approach to this. As much as we like to pretend and play that we are this super advanced economy that has this diversified base that supports it, we're not. You know, we are a resources economy, for better or worse. If you take resources exports out of the equation, our trade deficit would go to the absolute moon, you know, and there'd be implications for our currency, implications for interest rates, etc. But instead of recognizing the fact that resources are a big part of the story and that is, one of our strengths, we instead have pursued a policy, policymakers have pursued a policy of high immigration. which then dilutes the per capita impact of that resource's wealth, which is something, if you say, look at Qatar, that's something that they've very, very much tried to avoid. It's like, if you're Qatari, good luck to you. We are going to help you. We're going to, you know, not quite pave the streets with gold, but we are going to provide you with support. Same thing in the UAE. But here in Australia, we've decided, no, we're not going to keep the population small. We're not going to, you know, see migration or temporary migrants as a more transactional thing. Now, don't get me wrong, there's serious issues with human rights abuses and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, Singapore does it probably quite a bit better. But it shows a very different strategy. Whereas here in Australia, we're just like, well, you know, migration to the moon, that's going to be what boosts the economy, when I think we'd be better off with a lower migration intake that's a lot better targeted, which improves productivity and doesn't dilute the resources wealth of Australia as much as the sort of status quo does.
No, and Tony Burke, I think, recently said he didn't want to put a number on the migration ahead, right? So wanted to keep the fudge factor in there. And it's fascinating now that even the opposition, who were a little bit more definitive earlier on in terms of numbers on migration, seem to be wandering away from that. And nobody wants to talk about the true numbers, which is quite concerning, really, because basically neither side of politics really wants to address this is a really big elephant in the room, but nobody wants to address it. And, you know, it's over there. Let's not talk about it. Let's talk about other things. It's a bit of a concern, isn't it?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because earlier this week, I actually sent off requests in writing to figures on both the left and the right, so Liberal and the Labour Party, to ask them, people who had specifically commented on the issue of so-called mass migration. People who wanted to end mass migration, I asked, okay, what is mass migration? What level of intake, whether it be in per capita terms or nominal terms, would you consider to be mass migration? I then asked Labour, who said, we don't have mass migration. Well, if we don't have mass migration, what is it? What is mass migration? Same question to them. On one side, I got a non-answer, which did not provide any clarity whatsoever. And on the other side, I got a brick wall. I'll leave you to guess which one was which. And I just think that's funny. You know, here we are having a debate about migration, but we can't even quantify something as basic as what is mass migration. I mean, I think it, you know, should be a relatively easy thing of what is the developed world per capita average? And then if it's a multiple of that, perhaps that's mass migration.
Very interesting. But of course, people don't want to be made accountable for a number, right? So let's keep it loosey-goosey. Let's keep it all fudged, because then we can just sort of make political gesturing. And, you know, I think gesture politics is where it's at the moment, but that isn't really getting to the nub of the issue. And then, of course, the question is, well, are those people who are coming in, what are they doing? Are they working? Are they not working? Where are they working? Which takes us directly onto the question of the non-market story again, because, of course, that's where a lot of the migrants have actually ended up in. But not necessarily actually that effective, productivity-wise, but it's also making an interesting comparison with New Zealand, which is the next slide.
Indeed. Now, a lot of people like comparing Australia and New Zealand, and a lot of people like, you know, taking New Zealand, tying it to the fence post and giving it a bit of a kicking. And I think in a lot of ways that's unfair, because New Zealand hasn't been able to deploy this huge growth in taxpayer-funded employment that Australia has. In fact, it's actually been far more contained once the sort of roll-off from the additional headcount from the pandemic was ended. So if you look at the chart here, it just shows that how much non-market employment as a proportion of total employment has grown here in Australia since 2019. And I think it's also just worth mentioning just how much the labour force and the working age population has grown during that time as well for both countries. So this I think is just rather significant, that it's not that Australia is just much, much better managed than New Zealand. It's just the fact that the government has more willingness and more scope, both politically and financially, to throw cash at the situation And when I say government, you know, we've seen this in Queensland, we've seen it in New South Wales, we've seen it in Victoria. It's not a state or federal issue. It's a state and federal issue.
Right. And that begs the question then, because, of course, the momentum, as we said, is a lot stronger in Australia in the non-market sector, but they are dialing it back a little bit now, which then begs the question, so what is the job need in terms of growth of jobs to be able to keep unemployment roughly in the ballpark? Which is an interesting little conundrum then, because it looks as though it perhaps isn't going the right direction.
Well, that's good. It's a good lead into our next slide here. Now, this number takes the actual level of jobs growth since January this year and compares it against the level of jobs growth required for unemployment to stay static, to stay stable, based on the current level of the participation rate, which is the proportion of working age people who are in the labour force. And as you can see, we're coming up well short. And this is why unemployment has marched higher this year, because we simply aren't making enough new jobs to keep up with the expansion of the labour force.
Yeah. And again, this is the conundrum, isn't it? You bring more people in, needs more jobs. If we don't get those jobs, it puts pressure then on people already in Australia. So quite often, some of those new migrants are prepared to work for lower levels of return in terms of pay. And so that puts pressure on the broader economy. And if the overall economy, particularly the private sector, is underinvested, which is what's happening at the moment, the creation of new private sector jobs is quite limited. And that means that they've got the conditions then for a rising unemployment situation, which is interesting when, of course, Michelle Bullock at the beginning of this week said we've still got a very tight labour market.
Yeah, I find that quite interesting. I mean, to be completely fair to Bullock, I think it was actually prior to when she was named governor, she was talking about a NIRU, which is the rate at which, you know, unemployment, it basically acts as a neutral input on the level of inflation. She was talking about a NIRU of about 4.5%. So I think that on that particular count, she's perhaps a little bit less concerned about unemployment than perhaps other members of the RBA or perhaps even former Governor Lowe would have been. But I think one of the interesting things going forward is going to be how Bullock and the RBA cope if and when unemployment begins to rise to a more uncomfortable level, and then we potentially start to see Albo and Chalmers do their best Trump impression on the RBA to get them to cut rates. That's going to be a rather interesting one.
Well, it does highlight the stagflation dilemma, because in fact, if you've got inflation bubbling higher, as we think it probably is and will continue, and you've got higher unemployment, those two things are pulling in very different directions in terms of policy levers. And of course, the net result of that is probably lower growth. And of course, those are the elements that together create the stagflationary story that we want to try and avoid, because it's not good for anybody. But it does look as though that's the direction we're heading in.
One of my concerns going forward is that we've seen this sort of, for want of a better word, hope from businesses. It's present in the NAB business survey. It's present in some of the consumer confidence surveys. You know, this hope that, you know, rates were going to be cut and that the conditions were going to improve and that the economy was going to bounce back. And I think, you know, a lot of people have gambled on that particular scenario coming to pass. But with the recent inflation print, with the recent rise in unemployment, I'm wondering if we're going to start to see businesses pull back even more than they already have on investment, on hiring, etc. And I think that risks one of those, you know, nasty downward spirals. You know, I have no idea how likely it is. You're talking about something as intangible as, you know, how businesses perceive the economy, but if that pulls to be realized, then I think that we could end up in a very challenging situation uncomfortably quickly.
And I just will make the point there that the recent agreement between Albo, and Trump with regard to the US on taking some of our superannuation funds and investing it in the US, although how he can agree to do that when the superannuation funds don't belong to him in the first place is an interesting question, or the rare earths, where effectively the US will take some of our rare earths, so that's another, let's dig it up and chuck it over the pond, or the AUKUS, where we're throwing lots of money from Australia to the US. None of those policies are actually going to deal with the core issue of stagflation in Australia.
To be completely fair, none of the policies of anything really deal with many of the issues that we face in a meaningful way anyway. I mean, one of the biggest, you know, sort of themes, shall we say, of the Albanese government in its first term was public housing. Now, this isn't anything new. This isn't new ground for Labor. You know, this is something that Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard pursued quite vigorously. And to their credit, they delivered. They delivered the largest surge in public housing in decades. Albo and Co. hasn't delivered anything like that. It's basically just status quo in terms of public housing completions. Or even if we take the broader view of non-private housing, even if we look at approved non-private housing approvals, it's still not a pretty picture. So I don't think it's so much that there's no willingness on this particular issue, on the employment issue. It's just the fact that it's just very much a steady as she goes, we've all gone out to lunch, be back later type approach to policy making more broadly.
Yeah, look back after the election. She'll be right.
Pretty much right.
No. next thing to talk about then is the migration story, right, which feeds into this rather importantly.
Indeed. Now, there's been quite a lot of debate over how is Australia cutting migration. There's, you know, I don't think we've got a week goes by without someone saying, oh, well, it's being cut. It's being cut. It's going back to normal. It's blah, 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 blah. Now, what this charts is net overseas migration in Australia, Canada, and New Zealand balanced to its final pre-pandemic reading for each nation. And as you can see, both New Zealand and Canada have seen migration decline significantly more and significantly faster than Australia. And I think one of the really concerning things is that if we do see a re-acceleration in migration or even just a plateauing of migration at this level, it's significantly more than what, say, for example, the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council were expecting for their housing shortage forecast, which makes a challenging situation even more challenging.
Yes. And of course, everybody wants to say, oh no, migration's coming down, despite the fact that the overseas arrivals numbers seem to be going up again. And the ABS is saying, well, you can't use that because that's not the same as migration, because there's a very specific definition of migration, which you know, means we don't know until down the track again. But it does look, potentially from that early indicator data, which previously people were saying was a good indicator of migration, by the way, but well, you know, that's never mind. That's now. That was then. This is now. Would suggest a problem. As we said earlier on, high migration means demand for property, both in the rental sector. So we're seeing rents rising and available rents dropping, and of course, more people trying to buy property, which may soak property prices higher. Which I guess takes us interestingly on to then. So what's the story then? Are we building enough property to meet the higher need that we have? Whereas in New Zealand, with migration down, property prices there are dropping, rental availability is rising, and in some places, rents are dropping in New Zealand because of the lack of migration.
Shocking, I know. Wild stuff.
So let's look at the dwelling completions, right? So this is the Australian story, which is, well, a bit below where we need to be.
Yeah, indeed. We've basically seen how our dwelling completions bounce along the bottom now since the Albanese government came to power. Now, to be completely fair, it was declining from a previous all-time peak prior to the pandemic, but the recovery that we've seen so far has been, I believe that's actually at this stage, it's probably the worst on record. Now, the targets, the Albanese government's target was 1.2 million homes over 5 years, which equated to about 240,000 homes per year. But we've already now gone through a year of that and we've come up well short. Now, the Albanese government still insists that, at least elements of the Albanese government insist that this target can still be met. So for the purposes of pointing out the sort of, how would we put this, unlikely nature of that occurring, the dotted line at the top there is the number of dwelling completions that we need to have every year for the next 4 years, somehow, in order to achieve that particular target. I just think it's fantasy land stuff, to be completely honest with you. And I don't know how it's still alive. I don't know how the media hasn't just taken this and just bludgeoned them proverbially over the head with it repeatedly, to the point where they just finally say, fine, it's not going to happen, because no one thinks it's going to happen. Not even their own government agencies think it's going to happen.
No, and it's worth highlighting that the average time to complete a property is considerably longer than it was if you go back a decade. So it's taking longer for each property to be completed. The average cost of a new property to be built is continuing to rise very sharply, and that's a combination of high materials and higher labour costs. And of course, we have strong migration, which means that demand for property is still rising very firmly. And the mix of property that's being actually offered now, with the high rise rather than the low rise, also has a drag effect, because the average duration to build a high rise property is nearly double a low rise, because, you know, you have to get more approvals and you have to dig deeper and you have to build up. So, okay, yeah, you have a block with more units completed at the end of the day. But this is why this is just complete fantasy. We're never going to actually be able to achieve that number. And I know it was an aspirational target, et cetera, that they said it was. Although they were a bit more definitive, I recall, just before the last election. But, that was then, this is now. Funny. Interestingly, in the UK, we have 1.5 million target over 5 years, and we've got exactly the same problem. No way. Can't do it. Can't get the workers. Cost too much. Approvals take too long. It's the same story. It's like, why hang out these impossible targets other than for political purposes? It's posturing.
I think it's posturing, but I also think it's pandering to the base. It's saying, for example, if you get into a debate with someone who's particularly ideologically committed to Labour to a sort of concerning level, shall we say it? Not that that particularly is isolated to Labour. There's plenty of people on all sides of politics in that regard. But, you know, people they'll be like, well, we're going to build 1.2 million new homes, so we can have high migration. It's like, well, No, we can't. Because we can't build that many new homes. And just on the dwelling completions issue more broadly, I just find it, what's the word? Insane. I think insane is probably the right word. The fact that we've got a government agency in the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council who've put out some very good numbers, to be honest. I think that they've done a pretty good job of calculating the underlying, say, for example, I think they did a very good job on calculating the number of dwelling completions that actually end up making a net addition to housing supply. I think they did a very good job on that. And I think they did a pretty good job on the projections for the number of new homes that are going to be needed. Not perfect, not great, but pretty good. And I just look at that and they're saying that the housing shortage is not only not going to get better, but it's going to get worse until the middle of 2029. Now, how is that not a national scandal? How are people not just going absolutely nuts at the fact that they're being thrown under the bus by the government like this? Now, I understand that people have different views on exactly why this is happening. Some people blame property investors. Now, don't get me wrong, property investors have influence over a great many different problems in the Australian housing market. This isn't one of them. And I just feel like some people, okay, well, if the issue is property investors or the issue is Airbnbs or the issue is insert here, maybe press the government on those. Maybe, get out there, have a protest about that.
It's a big deal. And by the way, the FRB data showed, overseas investors, very low number in terms of the proportion of the total transactions. So it's not, you can't blame people overseas. Now, this is a homemade problem. This is a policy made in Australia by Australians for Australians. Again, I think it's worth just underscoring here. There is almost no media coverage of this gap and, the unlikely account here. It comes up occasionally, but relative to the must buy now, all the first time buyer grants and all of that wall-to-wall coverage. This issue, which should be center stage, is hardly discussed at all. I wonder why.
Well, it's funny because, I think, there's like people like me and Leith who put out articles on this like on pretty regularly. I mean, I put out one a couple of weeks ago at Yahoo on this. And I find it a bit disappointing that, I'm not going to go too deep into story time, but here we go. When I was in high school, I knew a lot of left-wing people. It was pretty common thing to see people who, sort of very much push back on a Catholic high school experience. So I knew, people who were card-carrying members of the Greens, people who were, very much Labor or Green aligned. And, they had this view of how the country should work. Okay. And don't get me wrong, I greatly empathize with their core views of, sort of compassion and assistance for those who need it. And I can support that, at the very least at a conceptual level. But to look now at the left, who are just letting way too much of this go in terms of the performance of the Albanese government on this issue, on homelessness, on the issue of, the mutual obligation system in Centrelink, the Centrelink system more broadly, the way that they've basically let, the whole robo-debt saga just, pass from the headlines without too much, real sort of scrutiny and prosecution. It's just crazy to me. That doesn't resemble the left that I grew up with, the left that I used to know. And just to be completely fair, I don't think that kind of tribalism and, the ideological blinkers are unique to the left. We saw that during, the Abbott Turnbull Morrison years, particularly the Morrison years, of just, it doesn't matter, everything's fine. I find the Liberals' crocodile tears on the issue of housing affordability now to be a bit ridiculous, considering the fact that they have presided over basically most of the recent huge run-ups in housing, most of the largest runs up in housing prices in the last couple of decades. Not that Labor haven't given it a good crack too, but the biggest ones have been under the Liberals.
Yes, and it does beg the question then, why is that happening? And I think it's because the true results and answers that you would need to get if you really wanted to tackle some of this fundamental inequality in the country would actually be quite painful from a cash flow perspective, from the government's perspective. They'd have to spend a bit more money over here rather than over there. And, I've spoken before about this idea of misdirection. So we don't want to look at that, go and look over there, look at the shiny stuff, look at rare earths or whatever, right? No. Look at the tents on the streets. Look at the number of people who are homeless. Look at the number of people who are trying to form a family but can't. Decade later than previously, we'll see in a second, there's an interesting data there. This is the tough stuff. This is the hard stuff. But because it's hard, they actually want to go a different way and want to you know, say, look over there, look at all that wonderful stuff that we're doing. You know, I'm up in China, or I'm, you know, up in wherever I am now, you know, and doing all this wonderful international stuff. There's a real hard discussion to be had about real people in Australia up against it. Neither side of politics, and particularly those on the left who should be, I think, a little bit more activated on this, they don't seem to want to talk about it. It's nuts.
Indeed. I mean, we need someone to channel their inner Kennedy, their inner President Kennedy. It's like, we choose to address the housing crisis, not because it is easy, but because it is hard.
I love it.
Yeah. You know, like, let's take a crack.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe we won't get to the moon, but if we get halfway there, it's still pretty good.
Absolutely right. Now, there's a couple of interesting counterfactuals here, right? Because, of course, we've been talking about migration. What would happen if we dialed back migration? What will be the consequences? Well, we can actually look. There's a little bit of a laboratory going on.
Indeed, there is. TD Economics in Canada have put together some fantastic numbers on this, which I'm not going to lie. I love this report. It's just fantastic. Like, this is only a couple of pieces of it. I'll link the full report in the chart pack. But basically what it shows is that if Canada had have maintained its previous rate of migration this year, unemployment in Canada would have likely hit 8%. That's the conclusion in the actual written element of the report. And it also shows that real per capita spending is now forecast to rise. And it has actually started rising since migration was reduced back in 2024. So I find this just a very, very fascinating piece of evidence that just blows up this idea that if you cut migration, it's going to be this enormous calamity. And I'll just add two more points on that. One, aggregate household consumer spending has actually held up a lot better than anticipated, which is positive. And also, even TD Economics notes that this has been positive because it has had taken the pressure off, in their words, the economic and social infrastructure of Canada. And I just, it's just perfect. It's just good to see real world data applied to these, to this very complex and serious question, when normally it's just dismissed out of hand because it's challenging, because, you know, it might impact headline GDP.
Yes, and as mentioned earlier on, New Zealand, of course, going through a somewhat similar process. They dialed back migration. House prices have fallen quite considerably now, actually, and the world hasn't ended. And the rental supply is a little stronger than it was, and rents are down in some areas of New Zealand as well. So it does show you that there is actually an alternative path. And as you say, you know, it doesn't mean the end of everything, and it doesn't mean that you know, we turn into a pumpkin, but it does, of course, have an impact on the broader economy, on GDP, and it goes back to, well, how do you measure success? You know, is GDP, not GDP per capita, but is max GDP the real ultimate objective and measure of success? And the answer is no. There are other measures that we should be thinking about, and some of those are a bit softer, perhaps, but very important. But there are also some harder measures looking at things like, well, so what is the cost of housing? What is the cost of rents? And, you know, all of those things. So the migration story, and if you zigged rather than zagged, what would happen? This is a really important debate. But no, we don't have that in Australia. That would rock the boat.
I don't know if you saw it, but in the Parliamentary Budget Office's report into the future medium-term outlook of the budget, which is the next 10 years, they did some calculations on what would happen if migration was reduced to about 150,000 people per year. And I'm not going to lie, it made me laugh, because there's so many people catastrophize about what exactly would happen if migration was cut. And if migration was cut to 150K, which is sort of, we'll call it about 20% above average, developed world average in relative terms. So it's, it's still on the high end, but it's on, you know, it's a lot lower than it is now. Debt at a federal level would be about 2.6 percentage points higher than it is today as a percentage of GDP. I'm not going to lie. I read that and I'm just like, are you serious? That's it. 2.6 percentage points of GDP. And that doesn't take into account at all the potential that if you had a smaller, better targeted migration intake, that it might improve productivity, which might improve economic growth, which would reduce the level of relative debt. And I just find it funny. It's like, you know, you're having this huge, huge debate, this enormous issue, this, you know, this huge alleged catastrophe over 2.6 percentage points worth of GDP.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the truth is, we know that the story is very different from the one that the politicians want to preach to us. And that's why it's important to get more data and look at some of those counterfactual positions. And look, as I said before, the formation of housing in Australia is high, you know, the first time buyers high. But that's not just in Australia, is it? There are other places too where you've got the same story.
Indeed. This is a really, really fascinating one. And it's also a very controversial one, because what it shows is that the cohort of people who were repeat buyers in the early 2000s in the US are very similar to the cohort that is the same cohort of repeat buyers today. Because basically that particular demographic has grabbed a hold of the housing market and they haven't let it go. Now, generally speaking, the performance for first home buyers by age has actually been relatively stable in the US. Now, that's partially due to the fact that interest rates were cut following the GFC. But if you look now, and also obviously property prices fell, but if you look now, the age of first home buyers is now pushing up to 38 years of age. So, you know, pushing up towards 40, which is roughly where some studies put the Australian first home buyer age. Is that roughly consistent with what you're saying, Martin?
Yes, the average home buyer in Australia is now 10 years older than it was if you go back 15 years.
Wow. Well, there you go. And I just find that interesting, because, you know, you're talking about postponed household formation, postponed children in a lot of cases. And one of the things that I just think is interesting in all of this is that it means that people are in the rental sector for longer. And rents, even by the US CPI measure, have risen by a whole lot more than the headline CPI. So I think that young people are not having their cost of living, at least in the US, captured properly by the consumer price index.
No. Well, I think that's the same here, by the way, as well. And again, in my surveys, I see that disparity between younger people, you know, the first time buyers, some of the most stressed, but the rental sector, the most stressed of all in Australia. And interestingly, as I just highlighted, I think on one of our previous shows, the most stressed rental sector in Australia are first generation migrants. So people who come into Australia and go into the rental sector have some of the highest levels of stress, based on my measures of cash flow pressure, than almost anybody. And I find that very concerning.
Well, obviously, I share your concern, but I also just find it a little bit ironic, because everyone's always like, oh, well, won't someone think of the migrants? But they don't ring you up and ask you about your data and how they're actually living and how they're actually faring, or whether or not they're being exploited and being forced to work for, you know, well below minimum wage, which is apparently afflicting something along the lines of a third of all workers, of all descriptions, whether they be migrant or whether they be Australian born, of people age 18 to 30. So it's just funny to me, you know. Like, I think we just need to sort of come to a, what would you call it, you know, a moral agreement perhaps on how we approach migrants. Like, okay, well, you know, you can talk about migrants all you want, but just stop using them as an emotional pinata when you need them and then ignoring them when you don't.
I think exactly right. Well, Tarek, we've come to the end of our show here, and, you know, this is Halloween, the scariest time of the year. And, you know, looking at some of this data, you'd have to say trick or treat. Unfortunately, there are lots of people who are being tricked at the moment. And I do think the trick around migration and the trick around lack of real income growth for many is a really stark story here. Let's hope, as you know, as we move beyond the scariest time of the year, that we actually have some politicians with a backbone and begin to take us in a slightly different direction, because the future is generally still open. We could still make the changes that we need to make to be able to take us off in a direction. But if we don't, then I'm afraid that the spiral down will continue.
Well, let me put it this way, mate. It's November tomorrow. It's almost Christmas. Let's make that our early Christmas wish, shall we?
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you, Tarek. Lovely to speak with you again, and look forward to the next one.
No worries, mate. Thanks for having me. See you then.
Cheers.